Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, our producer Katie Galley, for another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Stone, this is a very special one, isn't it?
Hey, this is going to be so much fun. We are going to have a conversation recapping our experience, our collective experience at FinTech South 2018. We're going to talk about the FinTech landscape and get a chance to visit in some real depth with our good friends at PPRO, who were kind enough to largely make it possible for us to even be at FinTech South 2018. So please join me in welcoming. We have James Booth, we have Steve Villegas, and Kaylee Palin, all from PPRO. Welcome, gang.
Hi.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So before we get too far into things, can you share a little bit about PPRO for our listeners that aren't familiar with your services?
Sure. This is Steve, and happy to be here again. PPRO, we are new to the U.S. from an office perspective, just opened here about 9 months ago. Based out of the European sector, headquarters in London, large offices across Europe. We opened this office. PPRO, first of all, is an aggregator of what we call local payment methods or alternative payment methods. So basically around the world, consumers use a lot of other things besides Visa and MasterCard, whether they're bank transfer methods or wallets or cash-based methods. And most of those countries don't use cards to use for e-commerce. So we help connect to all of those payment methods around the globe. And then we connect to large corporations here like First Data and Elavon and Global Payments. And we give them access for their merchants on e-commerce side to use these payment methods. So the consumers over there can buy goods and services from U.S. merchants using their preferred payment method. So that's kind of a long explanation, but that's what PPRO does.
And then the way that it works for a U.S. company is right now they might be primarily using MasterCard, Visa, American Express, the American kind of credit card system.
Exactly.
But online, they might have buyers from all over the world, and those buyers aren't able to use those credit cards. So then you give them
access. Or they don't have those cards.
They don't have them. Right.
Or they prefer not to use those cards.
So then this opens the world to U.S. businesses.
Exactly. Yeah, it gives a whole broader audience of acceptability for those other places to come in and shop, buy goods and services from U.S. merchants.
And do you find that U.S. merchants aren't even aware that they don't know what they don't know? Like
exactly. They
think that everything's fine because that's what it is where they are from, but they don't understand that the world operates a little differently.
Well, I can tell you, U.S. radio host, at least this one, was completely unaware till we started getting a chance to know these folks, I don't know, maybe a month, 6 weeks ago. And during that process, one of the things that came into my hands was this almanac. So now I have a copy here. I have a copy in another studio. I have a copy at the house. And you thumb through this almanac and you find like a country and you have, it's unbelievable the different ways that you guys are facilitating their ability to purchase goods and services. It's fascinating to me.
It's funny because e-commerce is just, it's such a booming business. You hear on the news everywhere, everyone's going online, everyone's shopping online. Here in the U.S., we live in an age of Amazon where you can get something delivered to your house in 2 days. It's just way more convenient. We have our established, you know, e-commerce markets. The United States is big in purchasing online as are parts of Europe. But then you have these markets that are catching up and they're just booming and growing by 70% in e-commerce. And these are largely markets that don't have credit cards. They don't have Visa, Discover. They have even cash voucher payments they use to purchase online goods. So it's really just getting a piece of the pie as e-commerce continues to explode from really these emerging markets that are growing by so much.
Now, does anybody have a feel for the amount that's out there for a U.S. merchant if they were to open themselves up to this alternative processing?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it very much depends on where the e-commerce markets or the e-commerce merchant in the U.S. is targeting. I mean, if they're going to expand to, let's say, Western Europe, it's quite easy to determine what their increase in revenue will be or their increase in volume of traffic. But what we find more interesting is as soon as you start opening up your consumer base to, let's say, some of these Southeast Asian countries, you have sort of tenfold increase in sales in these geographies when adding the local payment method. So it does very much vary by region. Sometimes you can see 3, 5, 10% increase. sometimes upwards of 30% increase in sales by adding these payment methods.
And then, so just by adding the payment method, changing nothing other than that?
Changing nothing else will increase your sales. I mean, a good example is the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. You'd think, yeah, the Netherlands, it's in Western Europe. It's quite a modern society. 60% or actually over 60% of their online transactions are all done through a local scheme called Ideal. And you just wouldn't ever think that. They all have Visa or MasterCard in their pockets, but they just prefer to use Ideal. And the American merchant wouldn't know that. They'll think, okay, great, I'm going to go sell to Dutch consumers. They'll start seeing traffic coming in. They'll see sales because, yes, ultimately they do have Visa or MasterCard. But as soon as you put their preferred method in the checkout, the sales just completely skyrocket.
And you were asking about what's the value of it. And I think I read an article not long ago that talked about the e-commerce ecosphere is somewhere like 3.2 trillion around the world, right? Globally. Mm-hmm. And so when you start looking at the dollar figures that are associated with the growth there, and I'll give you just a quick figure. Most people in the US can, and let me just take a step back and say the reason why PPRO opened up the US office while we're here to help in education, but also to help support, obviously, our partners here with that education, with materials, and everything that we do is behind the scenes. We're a white labeled solution, helping them promote this. Most of the US, and especially merchants, are not familiar with what is called Singles Day. And I'll use this as an example. And you may not be as well. I don't know if you've ever heard of Singles Day.
I have.
Okay, good.
I haven't.
Well, then good. Then this will be something new to learn here. So Singles Day is the largest online shopping day in the world. It started, I think, about 10 or 15 years ago, and it comes from Asia. Alibaba is the one that actually started this. And in one day, so it's an online shopping day, basically, and it was initially for people that were single to promote people being single, but they gave them shopping deals. This obviously has expanded huge in Asia, but has also gone over into Eastern and Western Europe. In the US, we're just now hearing about it. But last year, Alibaba in one day, this isn't taken into consideration all of e-commerce that they did, that was done in this one day. But Alibaba itself did over $26 billion in e-commerce online sales in that one day. You compare that to the US, we think Black Friday and Cyber Monday are big. I think we did $6 billion last year.
Right.
So when you start thinking about the dollars that are flowing out of Asia, out of Europe for this one shopping day, and US merchants really aren't even participating in it yet, there's a lot of money to be made and for opportunities for US merchants to take advantage of. Not only that, but obviously just global e-commerce in general.
Can you share a little bit about Alibaba and explain what kind of player they are in the world of e-commerce?
Sure. And James can help clean this up. I would say that they are, so AliExpress is equivalent to Amazon, probably larger in sales and volume, which we don't ever think of that because Amazon is so huge,
right?
A behemoth. And
but
so
the world is large.
Exactly. And there's, you know, keep in mind, there's, yeah, I think if you look at, so Alipay is part of Alibaba. Alipay is the traditional wallet that they use over. There's a couple wallets that we support, WeChat Pay and Alipay, which are the two largest. I think there's over 600 million users of Alipay. So Alibaba owns Alipay, and Alibaba is a large, you know, conglomerate of a variety of types of companies, mostly in the e-commerce space, mm-hmm. AliExpress and other pieces of their business that they own. So they are China-based and certainly the goal of taking over the world.
They're on their way.
But James, please add anything to that if I missed anything.
And, that's where it's important to have context. I mean, there's 300-400 million Americans, mm-hmm. right? But there's billions of people in the world that are using a variety of different things. So it's silly to just use one payment processing that's in our country when you have the whole world at your disposal if you're doing e-commerce.
Exactly.
So now for you, what's some of the challenges of, I would imagine that everybody wants in on this. Is that not the case?
Sounds like a slam dunk to me, guys. Yeah. Well, need both of you?
Yeah.
This isn't a one-man operation. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think as soon as everybody learns of the opportunity, then everybody wakes up and realizes they want this. They want a little piece of the pie. So for us, it's really, we're here to help educate the market and bring everyone up to speed and try to get as many merchants connected to these schemes as possible through our payment service provider partners.
So yeah, talk about that because your work is not directly with the merchants.
With the merchants,
so much,
no.
Right? Yeah,
no.
Talk about that a little bit.
As people, we don't work directly with any US merchants or any merchant based anywhere. We're purely a wholesaler for PSPs, acquirers, etc. So for example, if you're a US merchant, you would go to a local payment service provider or an acquirer, and they would give you access to Visa and MasterCard. We're plugged into the back of that PSP to give that PSP access to over 140 of our local payment methods. So our value add is for the PSP. So they don't have to go out there and source individual payment schemes, integrate directly into Alipay, WeChat Pay, Ideal, Boleto, Multibanco.
So do you find yourself educating these PSPs? Is that what you call it? Do you find yourself educating them or the merchants or both?
So, I mean, our main job is to educate our PSP partners so they can effectively sell downstream to merchants. But what we're finding slowly is we're moving into just a general education place. So we're educating both the merchants now and the PSPs in the US just to bring the opportunity of local payment schemes to America.
Well, I got to tell you, even for us at Business Radio X, right? Yeah. We have people who invest in underwriting series and shows and channels and events. And some of that is done through e-commerce.
Exactly.
And so we have a PSP. I don't know if it's okay to mention them or not, but I will. It's called Stripe. It's one of them. Actually, we have two or three different. But
yeah.
So don't you want me... You want Stripe to do that for me, but you want me asking Stripe too.
Yes.
Hey, do you have PPRO or do you don't even care about that maybe, but can you help me get into use Ideal or whatever?
Exactly. So, what we found, because we're founded and based in Europe, I mean, that's historically where the business came from. Obviously, there are a lot of local payment methods in Europe already. So obviously when selling to European payment service providers, they already know of Ideal. They know of Gyropay. They know of all of them. So we don't have to educate them as much. Obviously, we can give them access to the Chinese or the Latin American payment schemes, and they're already aware of it. So are the merchants in Europe. They know of these payment schemes because they use them themselves. It's different in America because consumers in America don't use local payment schemes. You use the international credit cards. So because of that, it's a general education play. We have to educate merchants who are at the end of the day consumers and PSPs. So we're attacking it from both angles.
So now, why was it important for you to attend and be involved with FinTech South?
It's very important for PPRO as a business. I mean, we've only been in Atlanta on the ground for a few months now. So obviously it's a huge step for the company to obviously set up operations in America and to really ingrain itself in the FinTech community in Atlanta and make sure that everybody knows of us, everybody's aware of what we're doing, and making sure that if anybody has any cross-border e-commerce needs, they know that we're the guys to speak to. And FinTech South was one of the obvious places to go and network.
So now, how was the event for you? How did it go?
The event was great. It was very good. For the first year, it was amazing, amazing turnout. Good show. I really, really was impressed.
Amazing venue, obviously.
Well, it was fun for us, right? I mean, to be able to broadcast live from there. That was a lot of fun to be right there on the field. We had some tremendous conversations. I'm just now learning the lingo here, PSPs and merchants. I don't know if we talked to any PSPs in our conversations. I know we talked to a lot of merchants, didn't we?
Right. We had a variety of guests that were vendors, sponsors of the, well, I think we did 20, 21 interviews over the day.
Yeah, one of them didn't count. It was James. No, actually, it was a fantastic interview.
You guys had a few First Data people.
Right, First Data.
Yeah, I remember Barry McCarthy with First Data. I thought that was fantastic. Also, what was fun in the Barry McCarthy interview is just as he sat down with our interview, you remember that great big circle thing at the top, the halo, the First Data thing came up. And so I took a picture of it.
We told him we did
good
that.
Time.
We told him we do that at every interview.
Well, going back to your question around why FinTech South, and again, why we opened the office here, is because we support so many of our partners that, you know, Atlanta is really the FinTech hub. They talk about how 70% of the U.S. processing volume goes through Atlanta companies. So all of those companies are headquartered here or have bases here, and we want to support them. And many of them were at FinTech South. So going back to that point of even talking about Barry and First Data, we had other partners that were there as well that we were able to meet with, some of their executives. And then, of course, our CEO also was able to facilitate a session around global e-commerce and what's happening in the global e-commerce space, the top markets that are growing the fastest, just to help, again, in that part of that education. And we're at the very beginning stages of that. We believe it's in its infancy right now in the U.S. in terms of knowledge.
Sure.
And as merchants, as payment providers recognize that opportunity and need, we know they're going to grow. And you ask, well, do we need two of us? Well, actually, you probably need 10 of us in the future. And that's what we're working towards, is building an office here to really support our U.S. Based partners that are supporting their merchants. And we know that's only going to grow.
And then you're going to build it from Atlanta outward? The team?
To be determined. I think we have a lot of West Coast partners. So eventually, you know, we could have somebody over in the West Coast. Right now, we really want to focus on Atlanta being the hub for, we'll call it the U.S. and then maybe the Americas as we look at expanding south of the border and in a variety of places that we'll consider.
And Mexico is actually number two in the fastest growing markets.
Really?
Last year.
And Mexico has a very interesting payment scheme in and of itself, but that's very relevant to the United States here. So definitely as we expand into the Americas, they're one to look at for sure.
So are you guys gearing up for some sort of roadshow? Like, are you going to hit other events through the course of the year and try to have similar conversations with other PSPs?
Well, we actually were just at CNP Expo as well, which is down in Orlando. Steve and James both attended that. We actually won an award, a CNP award for our services. And then we always have, PPRO has actually, for the last couple of years, always had a really big presence in Las Vegas for Money 2020. And speaking of Money 2020, FinTech South was a Money 2020 roadshow. So it was also nice to be present there in that aspect. We have a really great relationship with Money 2020. James will be there in a few weeks for Money 2020 Europe and Amsterdam. I'm not going to that.
So, well, that's a good segue, though, because I was going to ask you, Steve, James, what do you guys do, you know, on a typical Wednesday? You know,
we have various partner calls that are going on. We're supporting our partners. Typically, we have different weekly calls with very, very many of our partners.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of internal road work that goes on. There's new business development that we're working on for both current, for new partners, but then also on the roadmap for new alternative payment methods and making sure that we're sourcing the needs of our partners based on their merchants' requests, where they see growth happening. And we're working on internally within PPRO to help provide guidance in our roadmap and development efforts and a lot of those aspects. And then, of course, as we talked about, we want to begin hiring up here. And so we've started that process, getting ready to hire an integration consultant and then an account manager and a business development person coming up in the next several weeks. So that's all in it. I would say that's Wednesday. Then on Thursday.
Well, can you share a little bit about, say, a merchant wants to explore using these alternative payment methods? Walk us through what that entails from their standpoint. Like, what changes do they have to do? What conversations do they have to have with the people they're working with?
Well, I mean, I think it really depends on how the merchant works with the PSP. I mean, in most cases, they would obviously just contact their PSP and say, I'm expanding into this geography. Can you help me? Do you provide the relevant payment schemes in that country? Depending on if the PSP uses what's called a posted payment page, if they do, that means that the merchant wouldn't have to do much. All the work would be on the PSP's table to update the hosted payment page, make sure that the right payment schemes are being reflected in the checkout, etc. So for many small to medium merchants, there's not a lot of work. They just need to be aware of it, and they need to ask their.
They just need to know about it,
and their payment service provider needs to have access to it, so they can obviously activate it on the checkout. Obviously, as you go up in the scale, the larger the merchant, the more custom the integration generally is.
Uh-huh.
And if you look at the Amazons and the eBays and the real large merchants, the Nikes of the world, etc., they'll most likely have a custom integration, in which case they might need to make some technical changes on the checkout. And they just really just need to make sure that they're displaying these local payment methods in the correct way. They need to make sure that if a Chinese consumer reaches the checkout when buying some Nike shoes, that Alipay or WeChat Pay is displayed correctly and they're redirected the payment scheme correctly. That's really it. So it's quite simple.
And even taking a step further back, I think initially a merchant needs to be able to identify where are they getting transactions from in their global e-commerce.
Yes.
So are they seeing cross-border transactions through Visa, MasterCard today? And do they know where those are coming from so they can help identify what markets they want to go to first when they're talking to their PSP? What happens is oftentimes we'll have PSPs that'll ask, and then their merchants will ask is, hey, give me all. And today, PPRO supports over 140 payment methods around the globe. And they'll say, give me all 140.
Right.
Right. Well, they don't need all 140. And, you know, having all those methods show up in your checkout page isn't necessarily helpful either.
Yeah, exactly. Clunky, yeah.
So they need to identify where those markets are. And then their PSP needs to help guide them along which ones they need to start with. And that's where we come into play in working with the PSP is helping guide them and educating the merchants on that, some of those factors.
So
as well.
Now if you're starting this process, like, do you start with, okay, what's your, the lowest hanging fruit? Like, how do you, and you start with that one. Let's see how that goes for a little bit and let's expand the next two. Like, what's usually the evolution of that?
It's usually we'll look at the markets, and depending on where they're at, there's a handful that are the most predominant in the markets. If you're, you know, Western Europe, you're going to have 5, 6 to 10 payment methods. Asia, you'll have 3, 4, 5 payment methods. LATAM, you'll have 2, 3, 4 payment methods that'll be predominantly the ones that you need to look at. We don't recommend launching all of those all at once. You're probably going to launch 2, 3, 4, 5 to begin with and then expand from there. And really their teams have to be able to look at the payments and be able to, I mean, we're providing the full reconciliation files to our partners, and our partners, of course, are providing all the deposits and settlements and all of those pieces. But the merchant themselves have to be able to be prepared to handle that and take that in and be able to obviously deliver the goods and services, et cetera.
Now, do they have to make adjustments to their website in terms of, okay, now I have to translate this into all the different languages? Like, what, how much change do they have to kind of create?
It's highly recommended, right? Depending on the markets that they're seeing. But if they're getting a heavy amount of traffic coming from a certain region, more than likely, if all they have is English and there's no translation there, it's going to be problematic for them seeing high conversions, let alone the payment method.
However, website hosts like Google Chrome and stuff like that, they'll translate a web page for you without the web page.
So it just happens automatically?
Yeah.
On my computer, it does.
And if you see a picture of the shoes and you see a picture, whatever the picture is associated with Alibaba or Ideal or whatever, you connect the two dots. I got to ask you, Kaylee, because it sounds to me like you have some very solid job security for the foreseeable future, because this is a huge PR, marketing, advertising responsibility effort to implement all this, yeah?
Oh, yeah. So education is key, obviously, in the U.S. because, like Steve and James have both said, in Europe, everyone's kind of familiar with that.
Right.
I think in the U.S., sometimes we have a tendency to put blinders on, and we're out here and we're like, oh, okay, why doesn't everybody else use MasterCard?
Well, it works for us.
Yeah. So I love seeing people's expressions. I think when I start going into, well, look at how much money is out there. Look at, you know, my last three purchases, I think, came from outside the United States that I ordered online. So I can do it. Everybody can do it. Why not have them do it from the U.S.? I mean, we have great merchants here. We've got great products. We've got stuff people want cross border. So, you know, educating them on, hey, you can sell to this giant world instead of just one country. They're all like, oh my goodness.
Now, what about the, because you work internationally, the best practices in e-commerce, like we've been joking around, like U.S. is very U.S. centric. We think we're the center of the universe, but there's great things, and we're not, I wouldn't even think that that we are the leaders in e-commerce. I'm sure there's better ways to do a lot of things that are happening around the world. Is that part of your value you're providing, is kind of some best practices in e-commerce?
I mean, I think during the whole, I mean, because we sit behind our PSP partners, we provide a very consultative approach to doing business with our partners. So we don't only just sell these payment schemes into these networks, we actually actively help their sales team sell. And we have a dedicated integrations team that will guide them through getting access to these schemes. So it's everything from, I mean, enabling these payment schemes on the checkout is one thing. But as you get more sophisticated, there are lots of different tools you can use to optimize the checkout, such as localizing the language, as we discussed. Localizing the website URL also can help. There's lots of different little tweaks that you can use to optimize sales, changing certain language within the checkout. Instead of calling, for example, in Finland, like we found from our experience, we used to call it just Finnish bank transfer. And then as soon as we changed it to Verkkopankki, which is Finnish for bank transfer, we found our conversion just dramatically increased. So it's small things like that that we can provide value, and we pass down to the merchants. To
that's what I would think, that you're in a unique seat, that you can see what works and what doesn't.
Yes.
And then you can share that with all your partners.
Exactly, yeah. And over the past 12 years since we've been in business, that's where we've gained a lot of knowledge in the market. And that's, I think, why a lot of these partners or these big American businesses are coming to us, because they see our experience in the market and they really know that we're the experts because this is all we do. We only deal with alternative payment schemes. We don't even touch Visa or MasterCard because we don't want to. This is our specialty.
Now, the visual I get from all this is like we're all in a foxhole and we can only see just a little bit of the horizon except for James and Steve and his crowd. It's like your head's high enough up where you've got a 360 degree view and you can inform us and the people we're trying to, that's the visual that I have in my head because you've got a little bit of scar tissue, maybe education experience, but you also, your head's up above the well block there and you can see all the way around.
Well, part of the value that we provide is we do a ton of research and you mentioned the Almanac here. There's a lot of reports. Kaylee referenced our top growth markets. We just did a recent European report. There was a European day, actually, that happened a couple weeks ago and is celebrating Europe. And so there's a lot of these that we provide intellectual research around what's happening in the globe, both e-commerce and those particular countries. And then, you know, what's the economies look like. And with this is all white labeled. So we provide all of this to our partners that they can put their logos on it and turn it around, provide it to their merchants. So all of these best practices that we don't keep, we want everybody to know about them. So we try to put as much of that out as we can. And again, that's part of the value that we want to bring to the market.
We also, not just expertise, but with that expertise comes simplicity. So we've talked about access to all these payment methods, but access to that does not come without much time and hard work with getting contracts negotiated, getting these payment methods onboarded into our system. So, you know, why don't these PSPs just go get access themselves? Well, this takes a lot of time, legal. There's about 500 different parties involved in getting just one alternative payment method on board. So we have done that back end work. We've negotiated contracts. We've integrated our system with theirs. And so now we can offer 140 payment methods, what would take someone weeks, months, just years to get one. So times that by 140 and we're offering it to you in one go round. So,
great point.
So now if you had a magic wand and you were trying to educate more people, like what's your plan to do that moving forward?
Well, the magic wand would be everybody would know right now, right?
That would be
that the Business Radio X would be broadcast worldwide. So it would make national news tonight, and
then we're done.
Yeah, exactly.
Call it a day.
I think what our plan is to continue to not only educate within our partners and train their and educate their teams, but also you've talked about events, right? Kaylee mentioned CNP. We were involved in Transact, which is a payments ETA conference. There's another one coming up here in Atlanta, specific. And then there's a payments ed forum that we'll be involved in. Of course, Money 2020 is coming up. So we'll continue to invest in shows both regionally as well as nationally to help in that education and to promote not just PPRO, but really the payment methods. And then we'll work with our partners on that as well. So wherever there are opportunities, there's a lot of articles that we're also participating in, providing some of the research and the knowledge to help in this educational format.
Now, where does blockchain fit into this? We heard that phrase quite a bit at FinTech South.
Crypto.
Yeah, so we do participate. We have some partners that provide cryptocurrencies. And again, we provide access to our partners to give them access to those cryptocurrencies through those payment methods, Bitcoin being one of them, or Bitcoin Cash.
Blockchain and cryptocurrencies aren't the same thing, right?
Correct, yep. But they use, so the cryptocurrencies use blockchain as the method in which that transfer happens. So it's basically a ledger system. Blockchain allows, of course, the transaction to track every step between point A and point B, or you know, A to Z, whatever you want to call it. So that's part of it. And I think where blockchain will play an even larger part in the future, at least from our viewpoint, is as more and more banks, and you hear this term called open banking, which is really, you know, the ability for me to send money to you instantaneously. Today in the U.S., most of that goes through a process where it'll sit in the receiver bank or it'll sit in the sender bank and the receiver bank at separate periods of time.
For a remarkably long period of time, from my perspective, for it to be an electronic transaction.
Correct.
And
yep.
I'm not the only one that's happy about that.
That all has to do with the settlement house, right? So there is a settlement house that takes place. And there's also, of course, the banks like to hold their money for a period of time so they can make interest, and nothing wrong with that. That's part of their business model, but it's long-term instantaneous transfers. And part of it's been security, right? So in the past, having a secure method was the most important, because when you want to send money, you don't want it disappearing along the way.
Sure.
And I think this all started back with the Pony Express. So with, or Wells Fargo, I think, had the Stagecoach, right? When we think about their logo. So when you think about this, blockchain will allow instantaneous transfers to take place without the risk of fraud and a ledger system along the way, the checks and balances that's open to everybody to see, which will really help eliminate the fraud that takes place. So we think blockchain will play a part in this, in the bank transfer methods long-term, or this open banking going from one bank in one country to another bank in another country for that person that wants to receive those funds. And you could call it real time because they'll be able to collect it, those funds. So that's down the road. Who knows how it'll look like, both legislatively as well as how the banks will adopt it. But certainly blockchain will play a big part in that.
And then since you're international, you have to kind of be aware of compliance in all these different places. And that becomes your problem, not your client's problem. Is that true? Or you have to educate them? Where is that line drawn?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it's another value add that we provide to our partner because we do all of the collection of funds around the world. So we'll obviously today we have a license with the FCA in the UK and I think a pending license in Luxembourg that allow us to collect money on behalf of merchants. So that gives us the ability to collect funds around the world. And obviously we're looking at legislation around the world, making sure that we stay compliant. And that's something our partners can piggyback off. Obviously they can use our bank network and our collection network to take advantage. I mean, obviously, I think everybody needs to be reasonable and stay on top of regulation and make sure that they're obviously transacting in a legal manner. I mean, there are some higher risk industries, maybe in Europe, such as gambling, etc., where merchants need to pay particular attention to the regulation. But we look after at least most of the let's say funds flow regulation on behalf of our partners.
My guess would most of you have probably seen some type of privacy change based on what's happened with GDPR.
Right.
Right. So
I've gotten a ton of emails.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. And that's because the general data protection rights over in Europe that was implemented from the EU impacts everybody because of whether they're doing business over here or there's products and services across and how are businesses collecting and keeping that data. Certainly, we with our partners are it's extremely important that we're meeting the obligations that the EU is requiring. But it goes back, and I think anywhere you go, you look at what's happened recently with the whole Facebook data crisis, right? If you let your data get out of hand and it starts going down the wrong hands, wrong path, then it creates irritation at minimum, and then potentially it can blow up in your face. And so for us to help our partners along with that, as James mentioned, obviously we're doing the full collection and settlement, but when it comes to data rights and those types of things, working with our partners to make sure that they are in compliance, that they know we're in compliance. So there's a lot of checks and balances that go along with that. And it's a big piece. In fact, I'm working on two compliance documents right now for our partners and then collecting another one from another partner. So that's part of our jobs as well, as ensuring that those things are manifested across from each compliance departments, from ours to theirs, theirs to ours, et cetera.
Now, it seems that PPRO as a culture is one of, you're pretty good at sharing and you're serving and educating, that's where you spend a lot of your time. You have this great technology solution, but you spend a lot of time helping your clients become successful and making it easy for them to do business. Is that
That's huge for us. Our partner success is our success.
Right.
So we want everyone, we have the knowledge, we want to share it. We want people and companies and PSPs and merchants to all be successful. So I really think we've equipped our culture to be expertise in not only payments, but we also have a very capable and extensive, PR marketing department, legal department, compliance department. We really want to be well-rounded as a company and share that with everyone. So I think that's a big goal of ours, is to definitely help everyone else be successful as well.
So now, what do you see moving forward in 2018? What trends are you looking at?
That's a good question. I think certainly the e-commerce markets continue to grow. And I think that's a trend that will continue to grow. I think the clip is globally, it's 12 to 15%. But again, you're going to have markets that will continue to dominate both the news as well as actual domination of growth. And I think that's going to be one of the trends that we will see is as those economies grow, you're going to continue to see merchants be interested in entering those markets and asking. So we're already seeing that today where that is it's in its infancy, but I think that it will happen. even more and more. I think you're also going to see, as you look at, you mentioned blockchain and this real-time bank transfer type of atmosphere where it's, whether it's P2P or it's bank-to-bank, this open banking system where you're able to instantaneously, that's going to continue to gain traction because there's an interest there, there's a need there. And I think you'll see disruptive technologies and companies that'll continue to come out with those, whether it's a promise today of being able to provide that or the technology to be able to use blockchain instantaneously. I think the other thing we're seeing that's continued to trend is companies with certain technologies that reach a certain market point will get bought up by the larger payment processors. And there's a lot of acquisition that goes on in this space, this fintech space, to help current businesses, instead of them building new services, they're buying it and allowing those services to continue to remain and run strongly on their own, but yet they're taking advantage of the technology and obviously the revenue, et cetera. And the last thing I'll mention along those same lines is I think we'll see more and more collaboration take place in these industries. Like from a partnering standpoint, collaboration I think is big in the fintech industry, becoming bigger, where it's in the past, it's been very competitive just in the payment space alone. But as technology grows, it requires more and more collaboration between companies. And that collaboration just creates more synergy, creates more cohesiveness, and allows the fintech industry itself to flourish.
Now, are you seeing any backlash for, you mentioned some of these privacy concerns or this regulation. Are you seeing that actually impact consumer behavior?
I know what it would do for me if I were one of these things. It would make me be that much more motivated to work with someone that's already got it figured out. Right?
I see
it as an advantage almost.
Well, you have the Facebook. Everybody's apologizing. You can't watch TV without seeing a commercial of a big company apologizing for kind of bad behavior lately. Is that impacting consumer? Are they changing any of their behavior? Have you seen it?
Well, from our viewpoints, I think firstly, it's a bit too early to tell to see if there's going to be any large impact. I mean, certainly from the offset, we haven't seen that much change in consumer behavior. I think we're still seeing a lot of growth. So if anything, we're still growing. We're still seeing more online cross-border transactions. We're just seeing general e-commerce use increase. So yeah, from our optical view, we're not seeing that much change.
Right.
I think in general, what I see is it creates consumer skepticism around certain things. And so the things that you're more used to, that you trust, that have been verifiably trust them, whether they're companies or methods or what have you, you will continue to invest in those and spend your time, money, effort around that versus anything that might cause distrust. And I think that's just where we're at today because of whether it's media or whether it's whether it impacted me or not. I saw it, it's negative. I don't want to ever have to deal with that. So I would say that maybe that's, I don't want to call it a shift. I think that because of the environment we're in today, that's where consumers will continue around the world to rely on the trusted partners that they can work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just didn't know that if people, you're bombarded with security, privacy, all these things that are happening I didn't know if the consumer's like, you know what, enough already. I'm not going to buy things online, or I'm not going to use Facebook anymore, or I'm not going to do certain behaviors. I'm guessing they're not changing their behavior. I think that we're kind of immune to this and we don't even hear it anymore.
I think it's also a generational shift as well. I think as younger generations become the consumers, I think they're more willing to give up a lot of their data for convenience. Mm-hmm. Kind of like my phone tells me when I get in my car and I turn on 48 minutes to work. And I'm like, well, how do you know I'm in my car? And how do you know I'm even going to work? but honestly, even myself as a millennial, I'm more open to giving up my data for convenience. If I see, I would rather have ads that are geared more towards my preferences than not.
Right.
So I do think with the privacy shift also comes a generational shift when you're starting to get into the generations that have really just had internet and Facebook their entire life. And that's kind of where e-commerce on a broader level is just growing so much. I mean, people don't realize how much is really e-commerce. When I order an Uber on my phone, it's e-commerce. My husband's ordering our groceries online right now. It's e-commerce. It's really just taking over all your daily aspects of life. And I think that that's just how it's going to go.
Yeah. No, I mean, I certainly think the convenience play it's a very good point there that a lot of millennials and a lot of the consumers these days, they've grown up with a phone in their pocket that they used to pay. So why would they want to pull out a piece of plastic with a bunch of numbers on and use that when they can just pull out their phone and use their phone to pay?
Right.
So you're bullish about the fintech future, right?
Oh, yeah. I think everything is moving toward, as Kaylee just mentioned, James mentioned, as we move to anything being more of a card-not-present environment, right, and not having to pull out the plastic in the future, that really becomes an e-commerce transaction because you're storing your card. It's going through the system. It's recognizing it, but it really is happening on the back end. It's not happening at the point of sale necessarily. So that's going to grow. Again, it goes back to convenience. And there's a lot of models that you see out there that are moving to. Even, you know, you look at the reoccurring model where all of us probably have services that we pay monthly for.
Sure.
For convenience, right? Whether it's XM radio or whether it's, you're obviously cable and things like that, but
Netflix.
Even different services that you have that, you know, come to, like I pay, this is going to sound crazy, but I have a reoccurring monthly fee with my dry cleaner for a certain amount of that I know that, hey, I need to
Very
make
cool.
that have, right?
Yeah.
So they've even got into that type of
wow.
business. Where
I mean, I don't even do grocery shopping anymore. Living in London, I just used a service called Ocado. Just, you do all your shopping online. You choose an hour slot where they deliver it, and they deliver it then. I got so used to it. I moved to America here for the year that I've been so used to it. I've just started using Amazon Fresh, and that's how I do my grocery shopping. So I don't even need to walk into a store to pick up my milk and bread and all my groceries.
Well, what about us here?
It's Foodsby.
We have right. Foodsby here, so we'll get a note in the morning, and it'll say, here's the Foodsby schedule for stuff that can be delivered to your building today, and you pick it, and boom, and they have all your information. And
you get a text once here.
Yeah, so even some of us gray hairs are...
Hey, I recently discovered DoorDash, so I'm
yes.
so excited.
Yeah, I love DoorDash. So these local hires you mentioned earlier, I mean, you're going to be making some local hires. We'd like to help. What are you looking for? What kind of talent are you hunting?
Yeah, that's a great question. Certainly, there's various roles here. Somebody that has a level of knowledge in the payment space is fantastic, but certainly people that have, if they have great account management skill, background experience, even in the business development side as well, and the integration consultant, there's some technical skills that are required, meaning they have had to spend some time working with partners or customers in the past on the technical side of the business, and really have the ability to be able to have those conversations, people skills, and ability to interact with the customer. So
enthusiasm.
A variety of yeah,
a but variety. No, it's a special person, right? Because you want them to have that kind of at least appreciation for, if not actual technical skill.
Yep.
But they've also got to be genuinely invested, fit into this marvelous culture. It sounds like. And be genuinely invested in serving the client and the client's client.
Yep. Yeah, customer centric for sure.
Yeah. So you're trying to get you another James Booth, Steve Viega caliber. Is that possible? Are they out there?
I'm sure they are. I'm sure they are. Yeah. And again, they can go to ppro.com. I believe we have a couple postings up right now. We'll be having some more in the coming weeks, but certainly folks can look that up.
Need any radio hosts? Got any openings for radio host or producer or anything like that? No?
We've been talking about getting music in the office.
We have a sound system.
Yeah.
There you go. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story. Again, if somebody wants to learn more, the website is ppro.com.
You got it.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton, our producer, Katie Galley. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.